Recordings are started.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the IGO-INGO Access to Curative Rights Protection Mechanism Working Group call on the 8th of June, 2017. On the call today, we have George Kourakis, Petter Renforth, Mason Cole, Paul Tattersfield, David Maher, Phil Corwood, and Osvaldo Nuaba. We have no listed apologies for today's meeting. Also joining on audio only at this time is Nat Cohen. From staff, we have Steve Chan, Barry Cobb, and myself, Terry Agnew. I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for recording and transcription purposes, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it over to our co-chair, Phil Corwin. Please begin.
Okay. I'm asking everyone to bear with me a minute. I want to find the email I sent to staff at 2 a.m. my time last night after the RPM working group call concluded, which I was also chairing, just to make sure that the agenda accurately reflects what I communicated. So, okay, hold on. Apologize for doing this on the fly, but I want to make sure we're going to cover everything.
We can take, Patrick here, we can take point one first, and the new statement of interest.
Yeah, go ahead if anyone has updates on that.
No hands up.
Okay. Let me just, again, apologies for doing this on the fly. What I had gotten back to staff with last night, there was a draft document on pros and cons of our options one and two, and it simply needed more work before it was ready to be shared with the full working group. But we do want some discussion today of why that review is important to having a really solid final report that stands up to any criticism on what is a controversial issue within ICANN as a whole. So we're going to discuss why it's, and also the staff is going to explain the scoring system for potential risks and benefits and why it's useful to perform such scoring and how it's expected to inform our final decisions in this working group. Also, I don't see it on the agenda that staff has posted so far, but they informed the co-chairs they've done some initial research in regard to the actual incidence of IGOs utilizing curative rights process, although I think we have to recognize that that may be suppressed where the IGO doesn't want to get involved with the immunity issue. So they can fill us in on their research. And also the number three was, that's on the agenda, was separate DRP, which I know that there's a little inclination within this working group to go the separate DRP just for IGO route. But again, this is a pretty much a matter of crossing our, dotting our I's and crossing our T's to have a as bulletproof a final report as possible as it's launched into the waters of further ICANN consideration after we hand off to council and they decide whether to send our report on to the ICANN board. So so why don't we, can staff on item two, we don't have that document to review yet. We expect to have it for our next meeting, but can staff take us through a bit what they just describe the format of that document, the scoring system, and why other working groups engage in that kind of final analysis and how it can be useful and inform our final work product. So let's start with that. And so a brief overview from staff, and then we can get into any discussion or questions about that. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. This is Steve Chan from staff. And I would note Mary is having some difficulty getting into both the AC room and the audio. Her connectivity is not very good right now. So just a brief walkthrough of what staff had put together as a draft. It's a furthering of the work on the pros and cons document for recommendation 4 and the options 1 and 2. As Phil noted, it's still obviously a work in progress in regards to the language, and ultimately whether or not the working group thinks this is something that's valuable and worth pursuing. So the genesis of this was it was mentioned last week as a possible direction and something that might help the working group. And so for at least in the broad concept of doing this work, it seemed that there was support from the participants, at least for last week. So staff made an initial attempt at that, and while it does need some work and some further review by co-chairs, we thought we'd at least walk through what we're trying to accomplish or why we thought it might be useful for the working group. So the changes, what they were anticipated to do is to lay out a set of assumptions to help ground the risk analysis. So we're all sort of working from a common understanding. So for instance, some of the things that were included in those assumptions are to the degree of whatever solutions that this working group ends up recommending. The likelihood of IGOs using the UDRP, URS, or some separate mechanism in the grand scheme of things is a relatively small portion of those of that usage. Staff had actually done a little bit of initial preliminary research into understanding the scope of the issue, so to speak, so at least under some legacy domains. So I think Barry would be much more better equipped to talk about this research, but I think his audio is not connected right now. But I'll just try to explain a little bit of what that research was doing. And it's looking at how many IGO names are registered by third parties, how many of those third-party-owned domains could be even remotely construed to be used in a misleading fashion. And so it's really trying to look at the scope of when an IGO might see a likely need or even a remote need to possibly use a dispute resolution mechanism. So looking at that data or having that data might be instructive to this working group to determine what might be the best solution. So the other assumption that we had is essentially that options 1 and 2 are essentially antithesis of each other. One is better supported by registrants and the other is better supported by IGOs. And at least from staff perspective, it appeared difficult for those parties to really support the opposite option. So the concept of why a risk and likelihood analysis in this circumstance might prove beneficial is that it's intended to try and quantify the respective harm from each of the options and to see which is less risky, so to speak. And to the extent that the options are risky, are there mitigating steps that the working group that can suggest that can be taken to make the potential risk less likely to occur and less likely to impact either registrants or IGOs? So, for instance, one of the potential risks that staff identified in option 1 is that by vitiating the decision, that may be considered to not improve access to the UDRP or URS for IGOs. And so potential mitigations to this, regardless of whether it's deemed sufficient or not, be the suggestion the working group made of using an assignee or licensee or noting that we have that the working group has already noted that IGOs have selectively waived their immunities to file UDRPs under the current rules even. And so that sort of analysis would be carried forward for all the risks that we could identify for both options one and two.
Okay.
And
Steve, let me ask, we don't need to go, since we don't have a documented display, but we expect to have one approved by the co-chairs, hopefully by over the weekend or early next week, and then circulated well in advance of our next call. Rather than getting at the substance of what's in there or might be in there, it's basically to lay out the pros and cons of the two options, and of course what option two might look like in terms of actual elements is also up for discussion. That's not fixed in stone yet. So it's basically for the purpose of a final comparison by the working group between the pros and cons of the two options, some scoring of the risks to various parties, and then so we can all take that into account before taking a final poll with a working group on which way we should go. Is that a correct characterization?
Thanks. This is Steve. Essentially, if I could just conclude a little bit with a
sure.
few more comments, and yeah, I don't want to get into the detail anymore. And I was actually that was just one example, and I wasn't intending to go into further detail, but.
Okay.
The overall purpose of doing something like this is to try to inject some element of a data-driven analysis to these two options. You know, whether or not it's helpful is to be determined. But I think the working group has already acknowledged in the initial report, for instance, that neither option would be considered ideal for all parties. So this data-driven approach is intended to help the working group determine whether it can adequately address the risk and potential harms that it's able to identify, either registrants or IGOs. It could also help determine that the risks the working group thought were impactful, and just speaking about it, it helps to possibly try to quantify how big of an impact or how likely it's expected to be. And then so in the circumstance where it's not as impactful or not as likely that the working group initially thought, maybe it's a risk that could actually be lived with. And so, as I mentioned, because the two options are really sort of opposites of each other, it might be evidence that we need to search for that mythical third option that possibly exists that falls somewhere between and is maybe a compromise between the two. So just a little more context and a little more into why this may or may not be helpful to the working group.
Okay. And my understanding is that this type of analysis is somewhat standard procedure for working groups as they reach the final stages of work. Is that correct?
Thanks. This is Steve again. I'm not sure that it's something that's always done. I think in the circumstance that we're looking at two options that are they are essentially opposites, as I mentioned. It helps to maybe quantify between the two of them, you know, which is doing more harm, essentially. It's not something that's always done, but where it seems like the working group is having some difficulty in reaching conclusions on which is the best option. And this is just another tool in the toolkit that might help us reach that decision.
Okay.
So like I said, it's not always done, but it's something that might be helpful.
Right, but there's precedent for taking this kind of approach on in this type of situation. So I'm going to call on Petter in just 1 second. I noted that Mary was in the chat room momentarily and seems to have been lost again. And again, the document Steve was alluding to and part of it's my fault for getting to a late review of it, but it just wasn't in good enough shape yet for the basis of detailed discussion by the working group, but we expect to have it out in the next few days and give working group members several days to review it and then go over it on the during the next call. Petter, go ahead.
Thanks, Petter here. Just wanted to add that I've seen at least one example before back in the years where a working group passed on to the council to decide about like option A or option B, and that's definitely not a good solution and way to work forward. So I think it's good to have that base that the staff is preparing, and not just having the pros and cons, but also what I appreciate that what I've seen so far is also the some kind of evaluation of the risk and potential harms, because there will be some of the points here that we may not have 100% agree upon, but it's good to also evaluate what are the risks, what are the harms, what is the positive things with one solution when we weigh them against each other. So I certainly look forward to have this possibility to get a full agreement, or at least a decent majority decision in a working group, and I think that we will have a good base for that once we have seen the final summary from the staff. Thanks.
Okay, and thanks, Petter. And I note that Barry Cobb, who's done some of the research on that Steve alluded to on actual use of UDRP and URS by IGOs, and I know the quality of work that Barry always does, has put in the chat that it's now part of the GNSO op procedures as part of the, and this is a brand new ICANN acronym for me, I don't know what it means, DMPM recommendations. Maybe Barry can type in what DMPM means, but if that's now a part of our operating procedures and something that we're expected to engage in, we probably should engage in it. Particularly, we're all aware that IGOs are a politically sensitive issue within the broader ICANN community, and that no matter what we recommend in our final report, it's probably going to take some incoming. So we need to, as I said, dot all the I's, cross all the T's, and have the strongest possible final report where we can say we've gone through all the required processes and then some in reaching our final conclusion, because that'll put the final report in the strongest position. And I see Barry has now explained that data and metrics for policymaking, and it was recommended by a working group that concluded in 2013, which was focused on the use of data-driven analysis in policy development. So thanks. In regard to the staff review of the actual use of CRP by IGOs, is there anything, is there a document to go over today? Or is that something we're holding in abeyance for a later meeting? Yeah, and it sounded like someone needs to mute their line if they're using a straw. It sounded like liquid through a straw, though it could have been some electronic noise. So are we waiting for Mary, I see you're back in the Adobe chat. Good for you. Steve, your hand is up. Go ahead.
Thanks, Phil. This is Steve Chan again from staff. And I guess similar to the pros and cons document for recommendation 4, I think it'd probably be useful for the co-chairs to take a look at the data and determine at least whether they think it's useful before we share with the full group. I would note actually that Mary's still unable to speak, even if she appears to be in the AC room. She's still having some connectivity issues. But just just to clarify on that research, it's not how often the IGOs have used the UDRP or URS. So it's not a consolidation of the cases. It's more about the use of the domain names themselves. So as I mentioned earlier, it's you know, whether or not the IGO itself has registered its respective domains, whether or not a third party has registered that domain instead of the IGO. And then to some degree, which is a sort of a subjective exercise, whether or not that third party usage might be construed to constitute some usage that might be confusing or of some sort. So I'm sorry, I can't speak to this as well as Barry would be able to, because he did the research.
Yeah, well, you know, let's not belabor this. That's another document that hopefully the co-chairs can obtain for review ASAP, and we can get it out to the full working group and proceed with an informed discussion as soon as possible. I note that Mary, at least while unable to, being involuntarily muted in terms of audio, is able to type in the chat room, and I see that George Kirikos has his hand raised, and I call on George.
Yeah, George Kirikos for the transcript. Yeah, I'm a little bit concerned about, you know, staff doing independent research that, you know, seems to be self-directed. The data, like as Paul Hattersfield mentioned in the chat, I don't know what they're talking about as their domains. Are they talking about exact match domains in, you know, com.org? Are they talking about variations? Because, you know, in the RPM working group, we spent a lot of time talking about all the different variations that a mark holder or a rights holder feels might be infringing upon their claimed string. So it's not just an exact match that matters. You know, if the reserved list for ICANN on IGOs has maybe, what is it, 140 names or so? I can't remember the exact number. But the variations can be, you know, thousands if you just make, you know, very small changes. If you start adding hyphens and things like that, so and then multiplied by 1,000 or not 1,000, but say 700 TLDs, you know, we're talking about a survey of, you know, on the order of a million domain names. So I don't know whether Barry's looking at that or whether he's looking at a very small subset. So I'm kind of, you know, wondering what's going on. Thanks.
Sure. Yeah, let me. I can't speak knowledgeably of that because the co-chairs haven't seen the document yet. Let me say, this co-chair believes we should, particularly if it's recommended by operating procedures, go through all the suggested hoops for on a subject as sensitive as this one is within ICANN. On the other hand, we don't want to unnecessarily extend this working group, which has been at it for close to 3 years. We want to get to closure as soon as possible. So I don't know if Barry wanted to add anything to our discussion or if we shouldn't just move on, but the co-chairs will carefully review that document and evaluate it for usefulness for subcommittee review before it's disseminated. And I don't see Barry's hand up, so I'm guessing he doesn't want to... He wants to defer to next week. He's not dialed in. He's just in the chat room. So, yeah, let's put that one aside for next week. And so working group members can expect, hopefully, before the next meeting to receive two documents that have been fully vetted by the co-chairs, one on the pros and cons of options one and two and related risk analysis, and the other one on some data about IGO domain registrations and use of CRP, and we'll see exactly what's in that document. And that brings us to item three, which is the pro-cons document on separate DRP. I hope we have that one ready for review. And let me start the discussion by saying that this co-chair personally would be extremely surprised if after all our work and consideration, we reverse course and agreed with the IGO desire to have a totally separate DRP just for them and separate from the established UDRP and URS. So our review of this document is not undertaken for the purpose of any expectation of reopening that debate and changing our minds, but it's just, again, to have a record that shows that we did one final checkoff on each of these issues before getting to final report. And that's it. So maybe staff can take us through this document just a little bit in terms of the format, and then we can open discussion of any of the substantive points in it. So I'm looking to staff for a short, no more than 3 to 5 minute description of the format of this document.
Thanks, Phil. This is Steve again from staff, and I think Mary is still not with us on audio. So I'll take a first swing at this, but to be perfectly honest, she developed this document, so I'll do my best to speak to it, but we'll see how that goes. So I think you had also asked at some point, Phil, about why we would be looking at this again. And so just to speak to that briefly, you could construe this as sort of new facts or arguments to close out some of those discussions in the sense that a separate DRP is something that the IGOs and many other commenters had seen benefit in. So to that extent, it's something that the working group may want to conclude its discussions on. So the format of this document is pretty similar to the one that we did on the recommendation four, options one and two. It's simply a set of benefits and corresponding disadvantages. And then obviously the third column is going to be filled out and completed as the working group conducts its discussions. I'm not sure if you wanted me to go through each of the benefits and disadvantages. I think that's probably something that's better done by you, but I mean, that's essentially the format of the document, simply benefits versus disadvantages.
Okay. So, you know what I'm going to do, Steve? At this point, we've got a 2.5-page document. We've got about an hour left. I don't think our review of this will even take an hour. What I'm going to do is go through it quickly, point by point, go through each point, what's on the table here. I'm going to add my own personal commentary, and we're going to stop at the end of each point and see if anyone has any further comments to add, and I would expect we can get through that fairly quickly. So this is on reviewing the summary of potential benefits and disadvantage of an entirely separate DRP just for international intergovernmental organizations. Point one, wouldn't require any modification or amendment of the existing UDRP or URS. My personal comment is that so far we haven't recommended any modification of the UDRP or URS, and even in terms of guidance to panelists, if we're going to be dialing back the import of notification to WIPO of Article 6 tier protections, if we're going to dial that back based on the comments we received from being a entirely separate basis for standing to bring an action and just to just being evidence of common law trademark rights held by an IGO, we wouldn't need, that even reduces the amount of guidance we have to provide. So considering scope and applicability of a separate DRP need to be very clearly and narrowly defined to make clear that it has no relationship to trademark law or dependence on the UDRP and URS. And second point, need to determine whether a separate DRP would be similar to the UDRP or URS in terms of burden of proof and remedies. In terms of substantive scope, what would be the grounds that will replace the current three prongs of the UDRP, URS, and would be more appropriate or limited to something akin to a URS-type proceeding with a higher standard of proof and limited remedies. On that one, right now we've always talked about access to two separate proceedings, one being like the UDRP, which can lead to domain extinguishment or transfer, and the other one being similar to URS, which is a faster, less expensive process that only results in domain suspension. On the disadvantages, entirely new process to existing ICANN DRPs for only one specific group of complainants, and we'd need to be clear as to the exact public policy or legal grounds on which this is based to minimize the risk that other parties might be in due course petition the GAC or ICANN for their own special and separate treatment. So let me sum up here personally and then open it up for any discussion on point one. Yeah, it would be a very large amount of additional work for us to define, to create an entirely new DRP. In terms of the description, we'd have to debate whether it would be based on rights separate from trademark rights or on trademark rights plus other rights. And I'll comment here that in the continuing discussions of the IGO discussion group established by the board, there's been some discussion, but there's not yet really any identified clear and separate body, particularly on a uniform basis, that creates rights for IGOs other than trademark rights. And the suggestion of the chair of that discussion group to perhaps engage another legal expert to try to locate such rights is not getting a great deal of support from the IGOs themselves. So I'm not sure what the direction of that discussion group is, but they are on notice from they're aware that we're continuing to do our work, and that if they decide to go ahead and engage a separate legal expert, we'll take note of that and possibly suspend our final work. But so far, they don't seem to be going in that direction, and in fact, the pressure to do so seems to be dissipating. So, summing up, we don't know. We'd have to create that new and separate DRP from whole cloth. We're not sure what, other than trademark rights, it would be based upon. And if trademark rights are the only rights, begs the question of why create it when we have a UDRP and URS based on trademark rights. And not noted here, it may be noted later in the chart, but the IGOs have always asked not just for a separate DRP, but for a DRP in which there's no right of appeal for a de novo judicial determination, and that's something that has not found support in this working group. So I'm going to stop there. I see George has his hand up, and after him, Petter. So let's talk about point one, and then we can move on to point two. George?
George Rikos here. I'll let Petter go first because I already spoke, so I'll defer until after Petter has spoken. Thanks.
Okay, Petter.
Okay, thanks. Petter here. I'll be short, and perhaps this is not just comments on the first topic, but generally on this specific issue. When we talk about the separate dispute resolution policy, the first thought is, of course, oh yes, that's an easy of course, the most natural way to solve the problem that we're working with. But as we all have seen, when we started to deep a little bit on the topic, and as we also can see on the disadvantages list here, there are a lot of problems that has to be solved. In fact, not an easy topic because it has been up and discussed long before we had it on our table. And I also had the feeling, both reading the replies from IGOs But also when talking to some of them, that even if they refer to the old claim to have a separate dispute resolution policy, it seems that they can, in fact, accept the work that we are doing if we can solve the appeal part in a way that that can be acceptable both for IGOs and, of course, also for the domain holders. So, sorry, that was a more of a general comment on this. But again, it's we need to go through it and to show the pros and cons, to also show that we have actually discussed it again, and why we does not support that as a way to solve the problem. Because I had a feeling that this is a topic that we can have 100% common decision on. Thanks.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Peter. And thanks for conveying. I wasn't aware that at least some IGOs had indicated that if we can square the circle on the appeals issue and what happens if they successfully assert immunity, that they might be inclined to accept where we've come out generally. I think that's very useful information. George, go ahead.
Thanks, George Kirkos, for the transcript. Yeah, I think it helps to perhaps step back and go over the history of why the EDRP was developed. Back in the late 1990s, there was a rash of cyber squatting and Wild West kind of scenario where people were upset that all the cyber squatting was happening and it was clogging up the courts. And the idea was that the EDRP would come in as an alternative dispute resolution method. Mechanism designed for the clear-cut cases, and in a sense, it was very it didn't undermine anybody's rights because the court could get involved at any time. So the price of entry of this UDRP was that everybody agreed on jurisdiction for that the court, sort of the decision of the panel could be handled in the courts afterwards or during or even before the dispute was heard. So that's where the genesis of the EDRP is, so to speak, that there was a rash of cyber squatting, and so the policy was developed to handle to take a load off the judicial system. So where are we today? We have the internet after 20 years has grown substantially and people use domain names a lot more, but there's obviously a whole rise of a slew of different disputes that can occur on the internet. You have spam, you've got copyright infringement, you have disputes between registrants and registrars, disputes between registrars and registries, for example, the registry fly debacle. You've got disputes between registrants and registry operators, for example, this past week some people were concerned about some .xyz domains being clawed back by the registry operator due to so-called mistakes. And you've got price increases by VeriSign and Uniregistry and so on. So there's all kinds of parties on the internet that touch upon the domain name system that have disputes, and we don't develop a separate mechanism outside the court system for each of those disputes. There's no dispute policy if I have a an issue with Two Cows' billing or Donuts' policies and so on. That would be, taking away their rights and imposing an arbitration system where, their rights are somehow lessened compared to the existing judicial system. And so, actually, if you look at the IP constituency, for example, they're supposedly in support of the separate mechanism. I wouldn't wonder if, the tables were turned, would they be in support of a system where, I could challenge a trademark, that's being used in the trademark clearinghouse by a separate arbitration system. I think that would not be the case. They would say, go to the national authority that granted that trademark and cancel it there, if it's in Pakistan or Benelux. Otherwise, the trademark is assumed valid. And so there's a huge amount of hypocrisy on the system. Same for the GAC. You've got the United States government supporting this separate, arbitration procedure proposal that is extrajudicial. If I wanted to have a lawsuit against the U.S. government or the French government or whatever, I could not force them into compel them into a binding arbitration. They would say, come to our country, sue us in our courts, and that's your only recourse. And so there's a huge disconnect between what they want to do to registrants and how they view their own rights. So I think that needs to be kept in mind. Because we know that all these abuses occur for all kinds of other parties, registrants and trademark holders, the validity of all these Benelux and minor jurisdictions that are actually being used in UDRPs. So we don't say to them that no, we're going to have some panel decide what your real rights are, and we're not going to let you decide that you have rights that exist in the courts. And even outside the domain system, you've got people like Barclays who committed a huge fraud and were fined. We don't allow the Barclays customers who were defrauded to take them to an ICANN-sponsored arbitration in order to, seize the domain name as, part of their damages, perhaps, or some other bizarre, alternative dispute mechanism. Same for Wells Fargo, all the legal scandals and all kinds of different companies that commit scandals. So what we really have is a set of busybodies with an agenda that's really inconsistent with the underlying rule of law. They want their own forum shopping to occur. And why is this so important? Why does it matter? For an IGO with a very strong case, when it comes down to immunity, because if we set up this alternative dispute resolution mechanism, which I oppose, the same immunity question still arises. It just arises in the form of a different mechanism. So it doesn't actually simplify anything. So, but for an IGO with a really strong case, their immunity isn't going to make a difference to the outcome. They'd still win in court, and they'd win in the UDRP. So the idea that immunity actually buys them anything is silly. They'd win in either forum. When it does matter is when the courts would make a different decision for the IGOs than they would get in the UDRP or arbitration. This happens, when the IGOs are bringing the iffy cases, the ones that are in the gray area. But, for example, they managed to squeak out a win under the UDRP that they shouldn't have won. And rather than have that bad decision overturned in a real court, they want to play the immunity card so they can hope for another, a favorable outcome for them, a bad decision for the registrant in the binding arbitration. So, in other words, this is all about forum shopping. And we've seen that forum shopping does exist. The e-resolution UDRP provider went out of business because complainants weren't winning enough. So the IGOs here are complainants. They want to choose the forum where they, the odds are stacked in their favor. Because, IGOs can waive immunity, bring, things in court. They're the ones that choose the initial forum for the dispute. If IGOs really had a strong case for fraud, why aren't the national governments bringing all those cases in courts and arresting the fraudsters? There's actually a big policy reason to actually not allow them to have access to the UDRP, force these people to take these criminals to court, and get them to stop what they're doing. A court can say, you may not register any domain name that violates, an IGO acronym. And if you do, you're going to go to jail. They can do a lot more penalties than just simply handing over a domain name and allowing the cyber squatter to become a serial cyber squatter and infringe on somebody else's domain name. So the fact that we have got these minor penalties, really ridiculously low penalties for the clear-cut cases is perhaps against public policy. So back to
George.
Have you a few more minutes?
Yeah, could I ask you to just kind of, wrap up and so we can get on. I know, these are good points. You've made many of them before. And, again, this group it's probably not inclined to reopen.
I'll just finish what I'm saying.
Okay.
So we're not really talking about the easy slam dunk cases. The IGOs want this so they can bring the iffy cases and face no downside risk if they manage to squeak out an undeserved victory at the UDRP or before an arbitration panel. So it's really that simple, and we've been at it for years. That's really what it comes down to. And in terms of, you know, weighing the risks, you know, we have to look at this as, you know, a nuisance level thing, or whether there's really an existential threat. And, you know, over the last 3 years, you know, the NGOs haven't presented any data on, you know, huge existential threat from, you know, massive amounts of cyber squatting on their names. You know, they keep harping on, you know, cases of, you know, fraud and things like that. But, you know, where are all the fraud cases that are clogging up the courts that they need this, you know, system as a relief mechanism for what they can't do in the existing judicial system? That's what the rationale was in, you know, 1990s. Where is that rationale today? And so what they're really seeking, you know, is forum shopping, you know, a customized justice system that's outside the legal system. And so, you know, this second separate DRP process, it's really trying to, you know, reinvent the wheel, reinvent the actual judicial system. And it's not going to be equal to the judicial system. You know, it's going to be less than the judicial system. You're not going to have real judges, real courts deciding things if you know, we will go down that route. That was the gist of what I wanted to point out. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, George. We're going to move on to point two. As we're at 50, yeah, we have 40 minutes left. We have four points left to review. So I'm going to ask that as we continue discussion of these, I'm going to try to be as brief as possible, and I'd ask members to be as succinct as possible in any future comments with the aim of getting through this today. And if you have more to say, I want to provide more detail to put that in an email to the full working group. So point two, what the IGO has asked for is supported by the GAC and other community groups, and the IPC is cited. IPC has been on record for a number of years as opposing an amendment to the UDRP and supporting a separate DRP. Again, I have to note, we're not proposing any amendments to the UDRP that I'm aware of. So their concerns are set. I'll also personally editorialize. I'm not quite sure why the IPC is taking that position in regard to our work, because not the IPC, I'm not familiar with their official positions, but certainly many trademark owners were very distressed that the .Amazon and .Patagonia top-level TLD applications were rejected on the basis of GAC advice when there was no reason under trademark law to reject them. And within our separate RPM review working group, the trademark owners have not been disposed to allowing geographic indicators, which are not also registered trademarks, to be asked for, to be eligible for entry into the Trademark Clearinghouse database. So generally, other than this working group and the issue it's dealing with, trademark owners have not wanted to see other bases for disputes established other than those that are clear under trademark law. Turning to the other column, although the GAC at ICANN supports a separate DRP for IGOs, the issue of a separate DRP, whether it's for country names or IGO identifiers, has been a difficult issue in international circles, including at the WIPO General Assembly level, and I note that. That's very important if it's not even agreed to within WIPO discussions. What are the implications of ICANN being the first to adopt one? And I think that gets to the general question, and again, referring back to the ongoing ICANN discussion group, that as opposed to trademark rights, which are pretty much universal and recognized around the world despite variations in national trademark laws, they're much more similar than different, and they're almost every nation has a trademark law regime, and even geographic indicators, where at least they're more widespread. There hasn't been any identification so far of rights that are recognized broadly among nations that protect IGO names and acronyms other than trademark rights. So if we were going to a separate DRP, what it's a right protection mechanism. What are the rights other than trademark rights that would justify such a system? I haven't seen them identified. And why should ICANN be the one to step out and this working group take another 6 months to a year to try to establish the policy and procedure for a entirely separate DRP when we're not even sure what the right spaces for it underlying it would be? I'm going to stop there. I see George, and George, let me ask you to be as succinct as possible so we can finish the rest of this list today. Thank you.
George Grigos, for the transcript. And just to follow up on that exact point, on the other IGO small group mailing list that's public, they have been talking about things like, you know, consumer protection laws and things like that. But in those cases, it's national authorities that are bringing the action on behalf of the IGOs. And I think, you know, we've made that kind of clear, sorry, maybe not as clear as we can, that the assignee, licensee, and agent, the agent bringing the action could in theory be, you know, those national authorities. So, you know, the government of Canada or the government of Australia could bring an IGO dispute on their behalf, perhaps, you know, in some form of consumer protection mode. So perhaps, you know, that could be made clear in our recommendations that, you know, that the agent could in theory be the a national authority. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, George, and thanks for bringing that point up. I know that I commented on that list that the only national laws, aside from trademark laws, we should be looking to as the basis for a separate DRP, which would, of course, be a supplement to existing national law, would be those national laws which gave an individual right of action to bring litigation, not those which are basically regulatory schemes and are based upon government agency enforcement. And, again, so far, those haven't really been identified to any broad extent on that discussion group, including by the IGOs. And if those laws existed, they should certainly know about them. Any further comment on point two, or can we proceed to point three? Okay, point three, separate DRP may address the public policy concerns that have been raised by the GAC and the IGOs. U.S. government noted support for the IGO small group proposal, we don't want to exacerbate any GAC-GNSO conflict, but we want to have a sound policy proposal. And the counterpoint, this will tread entirely new legal and policy grounds, which is similar to the discussion we just had. There are big implications for creating a separate DRP that's not based on very clear and broadly accepted across nation-specific legal rights. That was my editorializing just now. The UDRP and URS are based on trademark law, and that's it. And I would add two things to this. One, the UDRP and URS being based on trademark law, another reason why I think it's appropriate for ICANN to have the UDRP and URS and maybe inappropriate to establish other DRPs, and there's a personal view, is that it's the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, and it's the names part. And ICANN's involvement with names that may be trademarks, that is the basis for the UDRP protection established at the onset of ICANN. It's not clear that other protections would clearly be related to ICANN's mission and remit. So far as the U.S. government position, my recollection of the U.S. government comment is that most of it was expressing concern about the use of WIPO notification of six-tier protection as a separate basis for standing, and it's been the preliminary conclusion of this working group in regard to that comment and others that were similar that we will probably dial that back and just have Article 6 tier notification be evidence of common law trademark rights. So I think we've addressed that main concern of the U.S. Frankly, the endorsement of the IGO small group proposal was kind of a throwaway line in the last paragraph of the U.S. government proposal. I've had subsequent private conversations with the U.S. GAC representative on that point where I've emphasized that that would the IGO proposal would deprive U.S. citizens of their rights to file an appeal under the Anti-Cybersquatting Protection Act. And I'd also note that there is no current confirmed head of the NTIA that the U.S. comment was proposed at a time after Larry Strickling had left and before the new nominee, David Riddell, was in place. And, in fact, today Mr. Riddell is having his confirmation hearing in the Senate Commerce Committee. I know that was this morning. It's probably concluded by now. I haven't had a chance to look at the video of that yet, but we should have a permanent new head of the NTIA confirmed hopefully before summer in the U.S., and we can continue these discussions with the U.S. GAC representative in Johannesburg. I'm going to stop there, see if there's any comment on point three. Okay, moving on to point four. Separate DRP not based on trademark rights is not likely to cause potential issues such as scope creep in relation to the scope and future of the trademark-based UDRP and URS. Okay, on the other side, as noted above, the implication of creating a brand new non-trademark law-based DRP needs to be more fully examined. Again, quick personal comments. We're not recommending any change to the UDRP so far in our initial report or our likely final report. And again, if I were an IP owner, trademark owner, I'd be more concerned about creating rights that weren't based on trademarks for governments and government-created organizations, particularly in view of the other issues that are percolating in ICANN. And I'll stop there and see if there's any comment on point four. Yes, George.
Yeah, but point four, I didn't really understand the benefit column, or so the separate DRP that is not based on trademark rights is not likely to cause potential issues, scope creeps. You know, there's a double negative in there, so perhaps that could be made more clear.
Yeah, thank you, Jerry. And I also, as I read that, wasn't quite clear of the import, but based on my knowledge of the IPC comment, I think it's based on concern about any amendments we might recommend to the UDRP or URS. But again, we so far we haven't recommended any changing a single word of the policy. So I'm not sure that's a valid concern. And that brings us to point five, which is a separate narrowly tailored DRP could help resolve the jurisdictional immunity problem by allowing for arbitration as an option for appeal. Considerations, the arbitration would have to provide at least the same level of due process safeguards as going to a national court. It would have to be de novo, couldn't be more costly or have more procedural requirements. The arbitrator would have to be neutral and independent, and we need to consider if the arbitration should be ad hoc or institutional. And in the other column, if arbitration is pursued as a sole option for losing party, what are the implications of removing a party's right of recourse to a national court versus preserving the jurisdictional immunity rights and privileges in those jurisdictions. All I'll say here is that, you know, we got a... The heart of the IGO's request for a separate process has always seemed to this group to be based in concerns about jurisdictional immunity for IGOs. We took the step of engaging an outside legal expert to inform us on the generally accepted scope of that immunity. He came back with a memo that said it really depends on the facts of the case and the jurisdiction it's being heard in. So we recommended in our preliminary report that the immunity question the registrant's right to appeal to a court of mutual jurisdiction should be preserved, that ICANN should not be in the business of depriving individual domain registrants of their statutory legal rights, and that wouldn't be a good precedent to set, and that the immunity claim should be, since it's a defense to being brought into court, that it should be heard, if the IGO raised the defense, it should be decided by the national court and not by ICANN in advance. So that's pretty much it. And, of course, the remaining question we've been wrestling with is what would happen if an IGO raises the immunity defense and is successful. What should happen then? Should that be the end of the story? Should the UDRP decision be reinstated or vitiated? Or should it go to an arbitration that, in my view, if there was an arbitration, if the court appeal was shut down, the arbitration would have to be as similar as possible to any court review other than the fact that it was taking place outside a courtroom and being heard by an arbitrator rather than a judge. Of course, we could require that the arbitrator retire a judge. So, but that's getting into it. The basic is that on point five is that it would resolve the jurisdictional immunity problem by depriving domain registrants of their statutory rights, and we've questioned whether that would be appropriate or even enforceable, whether we couldn't stop a registrant from filing a lawsuit, and it would be up to the court then to decide what should happen at that point. So I'm going to shut up and call on Petter, who has his hand up.
Thanks, Petter here. I just wanted to add that, frankly, I think if we decide on our option two, I think we have solved this point five, and in a way that could be acceptable for IGOs. But as I personally see it, it's also the best way for the domain holder. That said, we in the draft we are discussing, we are in fact, and I'm not talking about this document now, but we are in fact, as I see it, have solved the problem in a fairly good way. We are not creating a new dispute resolution policy. We are we are not suggesting any amendments of existing URS and UDRP, but we are showing a way to use the systems and then also to have a second phase that will be dealt with in a fairly neutral way for both parties. So having said that, we have solved this point as well. Thanks.
Okay, and thank you, Petter. I'm going to call on George, but I just want to note that while Petter mentioned option two, our current discussion is on reviewing and making taking one final look at the pluses and minuses of a separate DRP for IGOs, and that we're going to be having a very in-depth discussion of options 1 and 2 based on that staff document that we're going to have before us probably on our next call. So with that preface, let me call on George.
Yeah, George Kriegel for the transcript again. I just want to respond to what Petter just said about option 2 being better for the domain owners. That's, you know, not an accepted fact that, you know, people can choose option 2 on their own without going to court. You know, they can choose binding arbitration. Imposing option 2 on a registrant is necessarily worse off than the present. Going back to point number 5, I don't think it really resolves the jurisdictional immunity issue by having a separate process. It could still be handled within the current process, you know, with the relevant changes. All it does is, if we have a separate DRP, just, you know, moves the discussion to a different place, but it's still the same issue. Thanks.
Thank you, George. Okay. So I'm going to, as the person chairing this, my prerogative, we've completed our collective review of this staff prepared document, which is really our final chance to decide whether we want to stick to our original initial report conclusion that there's no, we have not been able to identify any separate, broadly recognized body of law other than trademark law that it could be the basis of a separate DRP, and that a separate DRP with no judicial right of appeal would unduly disadvantage domain registrants and is not a desirable precedent for ICANN to set any more than it would be desirable for ICANN to say that domain registrants in the EU should be deprived of EU privacy protections vis-a-vis registrar operations. So let me ask the question, having completed this review, is there anyone on this working group? And if you believe so, use that green check mark agree thing. Is there anyone who thinks we should reopen our initial conclusions and embark on a further discussion of creation of a separate DRP for IGOs alone? And George has just put an X. If you, I was just asking to see if there's support. I suspect there's not support, but I wanted to make sure that anyone who thought we should give further consideration to that. But okay, if you think we should stick to our, if you're against a separate DRP, put an X, and if you're for further consideration of a separate DRP, put a check, and let's get a sense of where this working group is at. Okay, we got 5 X's, 6 X's, I do not see any support from any member of this working group for considering the creation of a separate DRP for IGOs, which is not a surprising result. So I think we've done our due diligence here. We've given this all due consideration, and I think this subject is probably closed between now and preparation of our final report. So it's 13 after the hour. We're 73 minutes into our 90-minute call. Is there any other business? Petter, go ahead.
Sorry, just formal thing. I don't know how many signed up members we are in this working group, but as Mary said in chat room, should we also take the question to the mailing list? And I think that's something we need to do for pure formality so that we can have a clear
full member list voting on this topic. Thanks.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I was remiss in not mentioning that. I'm not sure how many what the full membership our full membership is, but I'd ask staff to prepare an email to go out to the full membership of the working group, subject to co-chair review before it goes out, informing all the membership of the discussion we had today, the result of our informal straw poll on the call, and asking whether any other member of the working group who was not on the call believes we should give further time and commit further work to creation of a separate DRP for IGO. So thank you, Petter, for pointing that out. Is there any other business that anyone wants to bring up on today's call? George, that's a question. That's a check mark. Do you have any other business to raise?
Oh, sorry, yeah, George Gregos, I missed with my mouse. Actually, I tried to change it, and it made the status incorrect. I noticed that the ICANN meeting in Johannesburg is coming up. Do we have any discussion about what's going to happen there? Because just to, you know, in terms of scheduling and so on.
Yeah, I know the final schedule was put up the other day. If members of this working group haven't seen it yet, perhaps staff can forward that final schedule for Johannesburg. Of course, it's also available on the ICANN website. I know we're scheduled for a 90-minute meeting of this working group in Johannesburg. I'm not, I don't recall what day it is, but there is going to be a meeting there. I'm not sure of the time difference. I know it's probably 6 or 7 hours ahead of the U.S. East Coast in Johannesburg, and so we will have a meeting, and so those who are in Johannesburg should be there, and those who are members who are not can participate through ICANN's excellent remote participation technology. Today's the 8th. I have a meeting next week on the 15th. We can the 22nd is just a few days before the start of that meeting. I'll be heading I'll be leaving the U.S. the following day, the 23rd, to get Johannesburg. It's quite a long trip from East Coast U.S., even further from the West Coast. We can make a decision next week about having a meeting on the 22nd, or whether we should just skip it and have our next working group meeting after next week's in Johannesburg. I know Terry Agnew has noted in the chat room that the working group meeting takes place in Johannesburg at 10:30 a.m. to 12 noon local time on Tuesday, June 27th. Steve has just noted that Mary and he will both be traveling on the 22nd. I would say that probably, hold on, I have to switch phones. I'm about to lose power. Okay. I hope you can all hear me now. So if we're not going to have staff on the 22nd, there's no point in having a meeting. So our schedule will be a meeting next week at our usual time of 1600 UTC, and then the following meeting will be the Johannesburg face-to-face meeting at 10:30 a.m. to 12 noon local time, which I know George is not enthused about what time that is in North America, but we don't control the final schedule for the ICANN meeting, and no matter what time we schedule those face-to-face meetings for, it's always inconvenient for someone who's participating remotely. So that's it. So I think we're done for today. We're ending 12 minutes early, so I'm happy to give you back those 12 minutes. And again, next week we'll probably be having a very robust 90-minute discussion of two new documents that you'll be receiving in the next few days. Okay. Bye, all.
Thank you. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned.